Hello, everybody. I'm Kevin Weiner, and thanks for tuning in to another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. And as always, I have a question for you. What do you think it means to be a Christian or to belong to a church? See, we're all aware of the stereotype. We've all seen their John 3:16 posters at the ball games, and we can all bear witness to the TV and radio programs that proliferate in our culture. Is all of this what Jesus had in mind when he departed from his disciples? In today's podcast and post, we continue our exploration of Jesus' last words with a look at his command to, "You also shall do as I have done to you." Join me now as we return to a watershed moment which will unravel 2,000 years of church history by redefining what it means to follow Christ. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. So glad to have you back for yet another program. Welcome. My name is Kevin Weiner. I'm your host. So glad to have you with me. Boy, we are in a series. We're on part two, and we are taking a look at the famous last words of Jesus. So we find ourselves in between The Passion, right? The Mel Gibson movie, The Passion of the Christ, and all of the miracles and activity in his public ministry. There's this window of time, three or four chapters in the book of John, which is what we're following, where he's in this upper room. He's having a meal, and then they go for a walk, and then they end up in a garden. And this whole time, he's talking to them about his leaving this world and what that's going to mean. And he gives them instruction, and he gives them a number of really powerful, important things. And we are taking a look at those. And today, we are in part two. It's podcast number 326, I believe. And it's called Famous Last Words Part Two. I call it Monkey See, Monkey Do. Now, if you were listening to this introduction, you probably, depending on how you align yourself, might find yourself just rejecting. Like if you're kind of in the fundamental Christian, you're very devout and you're kind of easily offended, what I've said may ruffle a few feathers. If you're kind of from the atheistic, agnostic, you don't really like a lot of that kind of Jesus talk, this was probably like, oh gosh, I don't think this one is going to be for me either. And I can tell when I have a post, whether or not the audience is going to, you know, respond and open and engage. And I just want you to know that this is important for all of us, because what we're doing today is a big deconstruction project, okay? And there's a number of interesting tangents I'm going to take, which I think are natural tangents if we're following the line of thought that this text reveals. But what happens most of the time is when preachers, teachers, Bible, people teach this book, they teach it as though it was creating modern day evangelical Christianity. They cannot divorce that framework from their interpretive process, and therefore they believe everything dovetails into what they have today. But in the introduction, I asked that question. Do you think really what we see in modern evangelical Christianity is what Jesus had in mind? Like he is somehow telling his disciples, go out and create that. Well, today we're going to revisit these final words, okay? Sound good? You ready to jump in there with me? So, like I said, we're revisiting these words of Jesus at that pivotal moment between the completion of his public ministry and prior to his arrest and crucifixion. So it's kind of this narrow window. And last week we examined what it meant for Jesus to say, if I do not wash you, you have no share with me. And I think that really opened up a little can, because let's be honest, most people see that as these exclusivity claims. And trust me, that the biggest exclusivity claim is coming to a theater near you very soon. You know, the one, I'm the way, the truth, the life, and nobody comes to the Father except by me. Christian history has abused that verse for centuries, and we are going to take that on. And so today, we're looking at this other one. If you're following along in the story, we're about John chapter 13, maybe somewhere around the 12th verse, where Jesus has kind of put his clothes back on, because if you remember, he was washing their feet in his tunic. And then they're all reclining together at the table. And this is what he says. "Do you understand what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you're right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you also should do just as I have done to you." So, like, the example here is this: look, I've served you, you serve me. Now, is he saying, hey, from now on, I want everybody to have to wash somebody else's feet? You don't wash your own, right? It's like, so come over to Paul's house on Tuesday because my feet are dirty. Obviously, there's more to it, right? The casual reading here is going to capture about half of what Jesus is saying. I mean, there's a whole contextual thing that starts to emerge in the original languages, which I'm going to share with you. Jesus is really appealing to a foundational principle of the kingdom, which is what he's been talking about for the first 12 verses of our first 12 chapters of this book. You know, his whole public ministry is all about kingdom principles, and namely that true leadership is influence. It's not about getting a title. It's not about being at the top. It's influence. And a leader who gains influence through power plays and leverages their title or position, they don't really have influence. What they have is authority. And that authority can tell you what to do, but it's not really the kind of influence that Jesus is trying to get you to think about. A true leader has influence because he or she serves and self-empties into his or her sphere of people. So you're leading from the bottom. Right. The former is known as the world system. The Greek here, they call it the cosmos in the general sense. And then in the specific sense, it's uses this term oikomene, meaning the Roman Empire specifically. So like a lot of times the Bible says world in English, but you don't know that it's changing that definition of world. Like it could be cosmos, meaning the entire world system. Or you're thinking world as in earth, like dirt, right? And that's the totally different word. That's gi. But you know, there's also this other term called oikomene for world, which is really means local system, like Roman Empire. And those are really come out in later verses in Revelation. It's amazing, okay? But this is known as the kingdom, right? This other system, other than the cosmos, there's this thing called the kingdom. So you've got these two ways of leading people. One, you lead with authority, with threat and intimidation and power. And the other, you lead with influence, by service and love and open-handedness. And see, remember, the world outside their walls was in racial, religious, political, and military upheaval too, just like yours and mine. You know, watch the news and you know that we're in the middle of all this. So this is very applicable to our world. Most people don't know themselves and most people don't know what true leadership is. Most people say leadership is a rise to power. But what Jesus is saying is true leadership is influence, and influence is most influential from the bottom. So institutional powers and their posture has always been that of powering over the other power. So like, this is why we have war, because, well, if I'm going to take on Russia or China or whatever, and we're going to have a war with Canada, it's going to be our power over your power, right? And Jesus is revealing that there's another power, and that's called the subversive power of love. You can take things out by undermining it with leadership and love. Totally different principle of operation. So one operating system is called the cosmos, the world system. The other operating system is called this kingdom. And they're totally different. And this is what Jesus' whole ministry was really about. And the famous last words, "You also shall do as I have done to you," are vital to these men and women who are about to go out into the world after Jesus departs from them. See, the power of love to subvert institutional evil and liberate the world is the mission. And it's going to be, and has been to this day, the single indicator of whether a group of people is an ecclesia, which means a kingdom assembly, a group, a gathering, or the cosmos, a world system. And so it's like, and now you might recognize that word ecclesia as what we call the church. But this is not just a leadership strategy, right? This is the definition or the litmus test to discern who the people of God actually are. Think about this. You and I grow up, especially recently, we look at the world and we are told that that building on the corner is the church. It has a cross. People go on Sunday. But that's a different denomination, this other one. Well, that's a church too. Oh, okay. So then the church is all of the denominations. In my town of 80,000 people, we have more than 200 denominations of churches. Yes, in our community of 80,000. What's it like in a community of 2 million or 5 million? It's insane. There's like 2,000 denominations of the Christian church. And each one says they're the one. You know, you go to the Mormon church, says they're the church. The Catholic church says we are the only church. Now, everybody says they've got it. They're the one. But here's the subversive message, folks. The only indicator that says whether you're a church or not is whether you follow kingdom principles or the cosmos, the world system. Now, from a modern viewpoint, what we're getting to see now is that modern religion has completely got this wrong. And whenever I go out and say, your religion got it wrong, I know I tick off a lot of people. And I know that when you're really entrenched in your church and your system and your denomination and you're wearing your team jersey, you get offended easily, just like I used to when I used to take that on. I had so many descriptives of who I was because I had fine-tuned the nuances of my belief so much that I was convinced that was the only way it was right. The church, the ecclesia, has become the place where Christ is against the culture now with this narrative. If you go to any of them, modern Christianity is all about this narrative that the Messiah will return with a power over ethos, right? They're going to come. Jesus is coming back. And when he does, you better have a chrome fish on the back of your car. You better be a part of a church. You better be paying attention. You better not be watching a rated R movie. You better have it dialed pretty tight, because if he doesn't, he's a warrior. He's got a sword on his thigh. He's coming back with a can of whoop-ass, right? This is this idea. The Messiah is coming back with power over, and he's going to free you from these oppressive powers that are oppressing you now. Seems like we've seen this before. Oh, yeah, that was in Jesus' life. The promised Messiah of Jewish history came, and nobody in the religion could recognize the Messiah because he didn't come with power over. He came with power under. He came with subversive power. I'm not that kind of king, as we saw last week. Now compare this to what Jesus is revealing. Christ is not evacuating the culture. He's not fighting the culture, as we see. Look at the context. He's redeeming the culture. He's restoring the culture. He's bringing disparate peoples together so that we could have unity, not uniformity, right? Unity is the bringing together of diverse diversity into under one rule, one way of living, and that is called unity. Uniformity is getting rid of your distinctives so that we can all be the same. That's what the world tries to do. Because it cannot have the true thing of unity. The power of love is the only thing that brings unity, folks. Outside of that, forget it. If you want the kingdom of God, you have to be a part of the subversive move of love, not a part of the power over work of the kingdom of the world. Okay, now these are huge watershed philosophies, right? I mean, clearly, whether you believe one way or the other, you go kingdom or you go cosmos, you're going down, your water is either going to the West Coast or East Coast, right? So Jesus' model here, which we are to follow, the church is an assembly, a gathering, an ecclesia. That word does not actually come from ekkaleo, as many people think it does in the word story. And I've detailed that in a previous post. So a lot of people say it's the called out ones, but it's actually not. The word history here is it's an assembly. It's a group of people, right? Which places others as greater than oneself. It's that simple. It is that simple. So it's not the modern cultural definition of a church. Like, you don't have to have a 503B designation from the IRS to be a church. Two people having coffee, talking about God, faith, and belief and love is church. Right? Wherever two or more are gathered, and I am there in the midst of them. It's not in a denominational affiliation. It's like, well, we're starting a church and we're going to align with the Southern Baptist, not just Baptist, but Southern Baptist. Or we're a Reformed church. We come from, you know, the Reformation. You know, it's no, we're Wesley. You know, we're going to be Methodist, whatever it is, right? It's not your theological distinctive. That does not make you the church. These have become adulterated. You have to see this. I know you love your affiliation just like I did, but those are adulterated. And the proof of their corruption is that they seek people to serve the institution. They're always trying to get people in. It's the McBean star on machine. Bring them over here, put the star on that belly. It's assimilation project. And the reason is because they believe that this world is going to hell in a handbasket. Jesus is coming back with a huge sword and power, and he's going to kill everybody who doesn't have the star on their belly. Get in the church. Do this thing. It's this whole, it's corrupted. It's preempted. And it's an institution that is not serving the people. It's an institution that's trying to gain people to serve it. I've been on countless church boards. No matter what they say in their distinctives on their webpage, the end result is that the people have to serve the church, not the other way around. We are to be the church, folks, not go to church. We need to evangelize the world, or do we? I mean, think about this. Do we really need to evangelize the world and create new little churches which hate our culture, which stand distinct and are just waiting for Jesus to come back as a little cloister of people huddling under a tent on a rainy day as the roof sinks in? We need only to serve wherever we find ourselves in the world and watch as each group morphs into the church as it becomes to trust the kingdom's distinctives. This could be your PTA. This is your little league team. This is your poker night. This is every single group in the world. This is your board meeting. This is your leadership call. This is your sales team. This is your everything. This is your huddle at the job site. It can become the church as soon as it becomes power under, not power over. Just changing the ethos changes the trajectory not only of that community, but of the whole world. And now we see why restoration is not only completely possible, but I believe imminent. This also means that any organization like a club, a gathering, a business, a government, a sports, arts, education can immediately become the church. You don't have to go and organize. You don't have to have communion cups and little wafers shipped to your building. You don't have to have a little storefront or an office or whatever. You can meet in somebody's living room if you want. Jesus never had a big church to preach from. There's no temple in the kingdom that he's designing. Why are we into all this? Why do we spend billions and billions on our little ego projects? It's insane. And because the church harvests so many dollars out of the culture, there's nothing to be spent on the poor. There's nothing. So now every other taxpayer in the world has to pick up the burden that the church has failed in its own mission. Think about this. Take billions of dollars that the church is siphoning off, redistribute it as it's supposed to be, and see what happens to the culture. All of a sudden, people are like, hey, I'm glad that church is here. It really helps these people. How about what about your church? How much a percentage of its budget is actually going to help? Yeah, maybe you do something with a food kitchen or whatever else. But let me tell you, I've sat on boards. I've managed church budgets. And I can tell you, if we spent 3% on anything other than ourselves, I would be impressed. Now, I know that's severe criticism. I know some of you are shaking, going, I'm going to write you a nasty note. And trust me, I can take it. It won't be the first. It won't be the last. But this is the truth. See, the very act here is that of subversion. Like, this is a deconstruction project. If you want to understand the church, if you want to understand what it means to be a Christian, you have to be here with Jesus in this moment when he is instructing his disciples to go out and be this. So any group can become the church if those leading it divest themselves for the sake of others more than they do the sake of the institution. See, that's when it becomes corrupt. That's when it becomes a system of the world. Is when you begin serving the institution, now you are, that becomes institutional evil. When the institution is serving you and it's self-emptying you into you and your life, now it's doing its work. The very act subverts institutional evil. This transforms everything. This is going to come up in a later installment, but the single aspect of self-emptying love will be the only measurement to determine who is following in Jesus' footsteps or who is operating from the kingdom ethos. Do not think for a second that you can say my church is the one that's right and we got it right and you didn't, right? No, that is not. You can't determine it from that. You know how you're going to know who really is a good church? Love. So let that sink in. Let all of this sink in. And I know I heard it when I was an executive pastor of a very distinct church with a strong biblical, you know, all the stuff. We were going to do it and we were going to change the world and we were going to convert everybody. And we thought every other denomination just didn't get it as good as we did. They didn't love their Bible like we did. Folks, let this sink in. If it's really hard to accept, it's because, just like me, you're a little over-identified with your religion. You're a little over-identified with your theology and your distinctives and your institutional power. Now, here's one final thought on betrayal. And I know this seems like a tangent, but it really is important because if you are following along in the text, and I'm not going word for word, but I am taking the whole corpus of the context into mind here. Most pastors and teachers teach this betrayal as part of something different. It's a different paragraph. So when they put the verse numbers, the chapter headings into the scripture, the original manuscripts, they insert that in there. It's not really there. And so when you run them together, there is a cohesive thought, but it's not as easy to capture. So most interpreters create these blockades, right, to separate these out. And verses 18 through 30 of chapter 13 are not incidental. Most readers of the Bible, they fail to connect to these streams of thought, like I'm saying, and therefore they're isolated from each other. And we have to presuppose a definition on betrayal, especially in this story. Because what we're going to see is Judas betraying Jesus. And we've all have some sense of what that experience is like. We've all kind of been betrayed, at least in junior high, if not since then, right? And to see between the verses here, it's good to try writing yourself into the text, into the verse 22, where Jesus says, where the text says, the disciples looked at one another, uncertain of whom he spoke. Because he basically just said, one of you is going to betray me. And they're like, which one of us is that going to be? And of course, Jesus reveals that the betrayer is to be Judas. Now, given the pretext of the conversation, is Christ following here by way of kenosis, right? He's serving by way of self-emptying. That's the kenosis, right? That's the Greek term. Or leaders, he's serving at the bottom. The betrayal of Jesus, exemplified in Judas here, is to remain steadfast in one's loyalty to institutional power and religion. So I did this whole riff showing you that the church isn't what you think it is, and you're offended because you're over-identified with your institutional power. And now I'm showing you through the text, exemplified in Judas, that if you remain loyal to your institutional power, that thing you're calling the church, which isn't, well, it can be. The real church can be found within the walls and the experience of this, but the main thing that you're defending is the institutional power, the structure, the scaffolding. And if you do that, that is the ultimate betrayal of Jesus. That is you being Judas, just so you know, okay? Now, how do I get there? Well, when this content finds its way into fundamental circles, it invariably meets resistance, just like you're like pushing back. And in many cases, I'm called a heretic, a false teacher, or worse, and it won't be the first, it won't be the last. And 2 weeks ago, some gentleman took issue with me and said that I hated the gospel and that God was going to judge me severely. And he quoted all these scriptures to me, of course. And such people, they're not capable of envisioning themselves as apart from the identity and certainty given to them by institutional religion. Like, this guy really did think he had it right. He had the truth. And it was his job to correct me, to insist that I was wrong, right? Even though I kept inviting him for a phone call, a coffee, a meeting, or whatever we could do, rejected it all and just blasted me with his correctness. Now, given the context of this passage, over-identifying with institutional power is the betrayal of Judas. That's why Jesus betrayed, that's why Judas betrayed Jesus. You're over-identified. Your name is derived, your power is derived from your institutional power. You became correct, and they said yes. They said, well, I'll defend you, and they said, we need you to do that, and we'll lift you up. We'll give you a name. We'll give you a life. We'll give you some power. We'll give you a group of people to control. And if you do all that, you can have authority. Now you see where I'm coming from. To be devoutly certain is to be the known betrayer of one's maker. It's derived by institution, right? Your identity comes from institution. It comes from cosmos, world system, and not from your maker, God. That's the ultimate test of church. If you can open your hand to the building, the services, if you're a pastor and you're like, there's no way I could turn loose of this because then I'd have to get a real job, then I'm sorry. You're over-identified. You're on the brink of being Judas yourself. The application here is that any time we derive a sense of identity from any institution, whether it's your family, your community, your vocation, your hobby, your religion, your country, your race, your politics, your sexual identity, your government, All this identity politics of everything is because we have no sense of who we really are in our Creator. And because we over-identify with all that stuff, especially religious people and their tribe and their denomination and their church, we betray our true Creator. And we live according to the rules of the world rather than those of the kingdom. The church has just become a worldly system that's labeled with a PR campaign said, we're the godly ones. The former is captivity, confusion, and death. The latter is freedom, truth, and life. And more on that later as we get into this service. So here we are. I've levied a huge criticism against the church. And it's not unfair, and it's not unbiblical. And if you are sincerely trying to find your way through all of this, you're probably sitting there Sunday after Sunday going, I believe so much of this, but some of this just isn't right. Well, listen to the Spirit. Ask the Spirit to reveal to you as he did to me. Ultimate betrayal has to be based in ontological truth. In other words, your sense of being. If you're not in the being of God, there's betrayal. Betrayal is not found in religious truth or practice. It's not like your denominational polity and alignment is what makes it true. Just because you're a good Baptist doesn't make you right with God. I know that's not easy to hear, but you have to get there. Otherwise, Judas' actions could not have been seen as betrayal because he sought to do according to the teachings and the traditions. His betrayal was simply, man, I'm a scholar, I'm a scribe, I'm part of this system, and I love what Jesus is saying, and I know that he can help him, and we're going to use this system. I'm going to get him back in line. I'm going to elevate him to the top of this system, and I'm going to get the powers that be to condone him, and I'm going to make it all work out. That's betrayal. See, he revealed Jesus to the institutional leaders because he was found. He found his identity, Judas did, in trading who he truly was in Christ for who the institution could make him into. And pastors and parishioners do this all the time when they insist on alignment based on theology and doctrine and historical practice. Man, I did this. I argued all the time. I got to know my Bible so well so that I could just give a biblical beatdown to anybody who didn't have the theology or the doctrinal precision that I did. I was arguing all the time. I have the right church. Yours isn't even a church, right? And I wasn't living in love. I wasn't living in the Spirit-illumined word in practice. It wasn't an experience. It was a mental attestation. I had to win. I was power over. I was deceived. See, in a sense, Judas was arguing the Bible with Jesus. Just like I would have. Just like Peter did when he lowered that sheet in his dream. I'm never going to eat anything unclean. You know, I'm quoting the rule of Torah to God and arguing it back to God. And God says, eat. You know, I'm never going to touch anything unclean. Wait, see what I'm saying? This happens all the time. It happens to you. It happened to me. We have to be careful. In a sense, Judas was arguing the Bible with Jesus while Jesus was inviting him to disrobe from the garments that defined him. And let's face it, that's what's happened, right? Our garments define us. We have to strip ourselves from any meaning, anything which would define us as other than our naked being before God. That's how we follow Christ. And now we can see how Judas' betrayal in his refusal to be himself in Christ was the betrayal. He's refusing to be the Judas that Christ loved and washed. The portion of the scripture, rather than being a separate thought, is actually the lens through which we understand Jesus' last words, right? I have given you an example that you should do just as I have done. So betrayal is not, it's not an adjunct here. It's part of the thought. And just as Jesus refused to be lifted up and identified as a worldly king, he rejected all the people's ploy to put him on the top. And just as he refused to be identified with the ruling class or with religious obedience, he did his healings on the Sabbath. He told people, pick up your mat, break this Sabbath, and I will heal you. Like, he was subverting the system. He insisted only on being identified as the Son of Man, the human, the lower portion of his dialectic reality. He's at the bottom leading spirit and flesh, and he identifies as the flesh. So we would do well to follow in his steps. This is what he's saying. He's like, whatever I'm doing here, take the lower route. Choose influence. Never trade authority for influence. Always trade influence for authority. Means don't take your seat at the top. Don't sit close to the master of ceremonies. Take your seat at the back. Christ following, then, is not an alternative religion. It was never intended to be evangelical Christianity on the radio or on TV as we see it now, inviting people into some system where you're going to have an evacuation strategy for the world. I know I believed it too, and you do too, and you think I'm a heretic, but I am trying to speak the truth to you. Imitating Christ is doing the right thing for the right reason and from the right disposition of heart. Christ following, then, redefines how we see everything in the world and allows us a kingdom field of view. It's not a view from the top, which is limited to the learned, to the elite, but it's a true view from and through the bottom. That means that it's possible to be a Christ follower, even if one doesn't identify as a Christian. That person you know who is the best person you've ever met and you don't even know what they believe, maybe they don't. Maybe they're Buddhist. Maybe they're Muslim. Maybe they're from a different religion. The fact that they are serving from a heart of service from the bottom is the way you know they are a Christ follower. And Jesus himself makes it very clear that you can be a Christ follower and have no conscious awareness of it. Many, he says, to many on that day, the righteous will come to me and say, when did I do any of these things? When did I do Christ following? When did I serve in the name of Christ? I don't remember doing any of that stuff. And he's going to say to the righteous, when you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. And so, folks, this redefines everything. And I know I'm creating a ripple effect in your mind that you're going to probably hate me for and push against, because now, you know, I'm saying you don't have to go on Sunday. You can actually give your money to the place that matters most closest to you, whether it be pets or people or homeless or whatever. You can give 100% there. It doesn't have to go to support some institutional power play that's out there to jockey for position and buy a new Jumbotron and put a new parking lot in and expand the kids ministry and do all these other things. All of that can be good, but in the end, you're just taking resource away and dumping it into a system that is actually working like another world system. Just because they talk about Jesus doesn't make it okay. Now, that may sound shocking until we realize that none of Jesus' disciples, his followers, his students, would have called themselves Christians. None of them were signing up for what we would call evangelical Christianity today. Only Christ followers. That's all they were doing. And who would try to model their life after that, right? That's all they were doing. I'm just trying to be like Christ. It's as easy as that, folks. Well, I know that's a lot to think about. I hope you will consider it. If you have questions, if you have feedback, write me, call me, engage with me. I would love to dialogue with you. God bless you all.